Olivet Discourse, Part 4, the fourth talk in a series on the Olivet Discourse, in Matthew 24 and 25, was presented by Ron Julian on July 21, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Looking at Matthew 24 and into 25, the Olivet Discourse, and I sort of remind you, I think in order to understand what's happening in this section, it's very helpful for us to jump back and think about to whom Jesus is talking and why he's saying these things. He didn't say the things that he does in Matthew 24 and 25, I think, primarily to give us clues about, you know, who's going to be the Antichrist or anything like that, but he was preparing his disciples for what was going to be a very surprising development in terms of the Jewish expectations about what would happen when the Messiah came. His disciples would have had every reason to believe that the kingdom of God, in the way that they understood it from the Old Testament, the rule of God on earth, the putting down of rebellious governments, including the Romans, who had the Israel under their thumb at the moment, they would have had every reason to believe that all of that was about to happen, that finally the evil and corruption in the world was going to be done away with and God was going to rule over his creation through his Messiah. Jesus had made it clear to his disciples. They had come to understand that he was claiming to be that Messiah, so it'd make perfect sense that we must be right, just right ready for this to happen. I'll talk about that in a second. What Jesus is telling his disciples is, instead, he has predicted the destruction of the city of Jerusalem and the temple in particular, and he's telling them that these things are going to happen, they must happen, and the disciples themselves can expect a long period of going out and proclaiming the gospel, suffering at the hands of various people because of that, that the world is going to have many troubles, and the city is going to be destroyed. You'd better get out when you see those armies coming. Better get out of this place because it's going down. And then ultimately he talks about the return of the Son of Man, that he is coming again to rule and to judge the world. But that hour and that day is not known to anyone, he says. I don't even know when that's going to happen. His primary concern throughout seems to be to prepare his disciples for this strange turn of events, that there's going to be this long period of time when he is going to be gone, and they are going to have to make choices, face into various kinds of suffering and whatever. They're going to have to face life without him. What we're seeing in the parables that we've been looking at, we started looking at last week, and we're going to look at some more here tonight, is these parables all have a theme of they deal in one way or another with someone who is missing and someone else having to deal with that absence in some way. We saw the parable about the slave who is set in charge of the other servants, and his master's gone, and he said, I want you to take care of them and feed them and so on while I'm gone. And there we saw it was the fact that the master was gone gave him this false sense of confidence that, hey, I can do what I want. And he didn't take into account the fact that the master, if he was going to take that attitude, was going to end up sooner than he expected, and he was going to have to give an accounting for what he did. And then we talked about the parable of the 10 virgins, the 10 maidens, where all of the maidens went out with the expectation that they were going to wait for the bridegroom, but 5 of them were not prepared for the fact that he might be a long time in coming. And so there we saw the problem being not having what it takes to last out, to make it, if the bridegroom is long in coming. And Jesus very clearly implying there to his disciples what we have in fact seen has happened, is that it has been a very long time in his coming and he's not back yet. But that parable was meant to fortify them, meant to show them that, look, there are situations where you need to be prepared for it to be a long time before the awaited event comes. The parable that we're going to look at next is also about someone who leaves and who leaves some people in charge, leaves them with a task to do while he's gone. This parable is repeated essentially. It has some differences in detail which are interesting, but it's repeated essentially in Luke 19. And part of what I think is interesting about the Luke 19 passage, this is what I was going to mention just a second ago, in Luke 19:11, he says, "And while they were listening to these things, he went on to tell a parable, because he was near Jerusalem, and they supposed that the kingdom of God was going to appear immediately." See, there's that very theme that I was talking about. Very natural for his disciples to think, well, this is going to happen right away, right? I mean, why wouldn't it? But what's interesting here is that this parable is given specifically. As he's giving it as a kind of an antidote to the idea that the kingdom is going to come immediately. And he tells this parable having to do with someone who goes away and gives a task to his servants while he's gone. So let me read the version that we have in Matthew, and then we'll talk about it. We're in Matthew 25:14. "For it is just like a man about to go on a journey, who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. And to one he gave 5 talents," and a talent is an amount of money, so we understand, "to another 2, and to another 1, each according to his own ability. And he went on his journey. Immediately the one who had received the 5 talents went and traded with them and gained 5 more talents. In the same manner, the one who had received the 2 talents gained 2 more. But he who received the 1 talent went away and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. And the one who had received the 5 talents came up and brought 5 more talents, saying, 'Master, you entrusted 5 talents to me. See, I have gained 5 more talents.' His master said to him, 'Well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master.' The one also who had received the 2 talents came up and said, 'Master, you entrusted to me 2 talents. See, I have gained 2 more talents.' His master said to him, 'Well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things, I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master.' And the one also who had received the 1 talent came up and said, 'Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, and gathering where you scattered no seed. And I was afraid, and went away and hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours.' But his master answered and said to him, 'You wicked, lazy slave, you knew that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have put my money in the bank, and on my arrival I would have received my money back with interest. Therefore take away the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. For to everyone who has shall more be given, and he shall have an abundance. But from the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. And cast out the worthless slave into the outer darkness. In that place there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Okay, well, see, the thing is that I don't know what this parable means, which is a little embarrassing since I'm about to teach it. But am I going to let that stop me from telling? No, I'm not going to let that stop me. Why should a little ignorance count for anything between friends, right? What I want to do is explain to you what I think the issues are here regarding this parable. And I'm going to do something that I really dislike doing. But I'm going to do it anyway because it needs to be done. I'm going to tell you what Jack says this parable means. You'll see. I want to start by talking a second about parables and the way they need to be interpreted. I love the parables, but I think it's important to understand the sort of thing they are. There is a mistake that can be made, and I'm sure many of you have heard me talk about this many times, but there is a mistake that can be made with the parables, I think, that can cause us to miss the point of most of them. If we treat the parables as if they were kind of a code to be decoded, so in this case, I would come to this parable and the first question I would ask would be, all right, so what do the talents represent? What do the talents stand for? And so we nominate various things for that and we sort of plug it in, and then at the end, we read it back with our plugged in coded values, and we think, aha, I've gotten the message. There are things like that in the Bible. I think if you go and look at the book of Revelation, and you look at all of the different pictures that are in there, that method works very well. When you see a picture of Jesus, and his eyes are on fire, and there's a sword coming out of his mouth, the question to ask is, what does the sword represent? Why is his robe white? What does that represent? And in fact, when you go and decode it and you plug in the values, you get, in fact, what it was that the vision in Revelation was supposed to represent. But I don't think that works when it comes to the parables. These parables are real-life sort of stories that the people that Jesus is talking to would have understood. They would have looked at the story and said, yeah, I can see what's happening. When he tells a story about somebody knocking on the door late at night, the people involved understand the dynamic of that story. They understand the motives of the people involved. They understand how the guy inside would have felt and why he would have gotten up. A classic example of this to me is, just to give you an example of what I'm talking about, is the little parable that Jesus tells about the mustard seed. The kingdom of God is like a mustard seed, which is the smallest of the seeds of the garden, of the plants of the garden, he says. And yet when it grows up, it's the biggest of them. It turns into this big tree and birds come and nest in its branches. Well, there's a very popular way of understanding that parable that says, look, we have to go in and decode the different pieces in the story. What do the birds represent in that story? Well, Jesus told a parable earlier where the birds represented Satan, who came and took the word away. You know, the birds came and ate the seed along the side of the road. So we know that the birds represent Satan. So what does it mean for the birds to come and nest in the branches of the tree? Well, that must mean that somehow evil is going to creep into the church and it's going to live in the branches and we're not going to be able to get rid of it or something like that. See, I mean, that's fine, but my argument would be, if we look at that story and think about it the way someone living in the area at the time would have thought about it, if you think about that story, when the bird comes and eats the seed that a sower is trying to sow, it's easy to see why that would represent something evil, because the whole point of the sower was to sow the seed, and here this bird comes along and eat it. That's not what I wanted. But in a story about birds nesting in the branches of a tree, are the birds doing anything to the tree? I mean, all you have to do is look around. Look out right here, and you'll see that birds and trees get along really well. And they always have. So there isn't any reason to think that the bird being in the tree would for somebody thinking about that story, that it would represent anything evil or anything bad that they would think about. Well, what does it represent in the story? I mean, in the story itself, what is it doing? Well, just think about that little story. It's a story about, he says, gee, it's a funny thing. When you go out and look in the garden, there's all these seeds. Let's look at the seeds that you're going to plant. And there's some pretty big ones, and there's some smaller ones, medium-sized ones, and you get down to there's this one that's the smallest one. Now, look at those seeds and predict which of them is going to be big and which of them is going to be small. You'd kind of think that this big old thing over here, that's going to turn into something really big. And this small little seed over here, that's hardly worth even commenting on. I could throw this away and never even miss it. But funny thing about gardening, you take that little seed that looks so negligible that you could throw it away and never miss it, and in fact it ends up being the dominant feature in the garden. It starts out small and it ends up really big. So big that birds, I mean, here's this big old bird and here's this little old seed. Now this becomes a home for birds. It's become so big that the birds that could have come along and eaten it up and it'd be gone before, now there can be a flock of them up there in the tree. In fact, I don't know, in our neighborhood here, recently just down that way, in our the trees around our place have been filled with birds lately. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of them. You go outside and you almost want to put on earplugs or something. It's incredibly loud, and every now and again, a whole swarm of them takes off from the trees and the sky gets black. I mean, it's just black with birds. So those trees can hold an awful lot of birds, and there's no problem there. Why would Jesus tell a story like that? Because he's saying that the kingdom of God is like that. Funny thing, if you looked at it at its beginning, you'd look at it and think, this thing is so negligible that you could just toss it away and you'd never miss it. I think that's the point that he's getting at. But this thing that starts out so small that it looks as if it's hardly anything, in the end is going to be the dominant feature of the landscape. It's going to overshadow everything else. That's the point of his story. Now, having understood that, we can go and ask the question if we want, well, what does the seed represent? But that's not exactly the way to ask the question. The question is, what's happening in this story and why is it like the kingdom of God? It's not so much that one thing represents another, but that there's an idea in that story. There's an interesting play of ideas and emotions and things. And when you look at those things, he's saying, that's what's like the kingdom of God. That surprise you feel when you look at this small seed and see what it turns into, that's the surprise you're going to feel when you look at the kingdom of God, because that's the way it's going to turn out. So, when we come to a story like this, the one that I just read, and we see this story about talents that the master left with the servants. I think, for myself, the place to start is not with the question, what do the talents represent? But the place to start is to try to understand this story. What's going on in the story? And that's part of what's difficult with this one, I think. This is, for me, having really enjoyed the parables for a long time and having thought about most of them a lot at one time or another, this is one of those parables that is sort of have been stewing on it for 20 years or something like that. So, I mean, you can see how slow I am. I've been thinking about this parable for 20 years and I still don't know what it means. But let me show you what I think I see happening here, and I want to tell you what Jack says, which is very intriguing and may be right. And then I'm interested, if we have time, for any thoughts that you may have about what's going on with this story. The key, of course, is this picture of the master who has gone away and who has left these servants with a task to perform. Jesus is clearly saying that there's an analogy, that he in fact is going away, he being our master who is ultimately going to come and we're going to have to give an accounting to him of what we did. All of that is very easy to see, the analogy. And if the story were just about the first two servants, I think it would be easy to understand what was happening. I mean, it would be a fairly simple story. The master goes away. The two servants are given a task. They perform it, and he comes back and says, good job. And because you were faithful, I'm going to give you more to be responsible for because you were faithful. And we probably wouldn't go any farther with it than to ask the question, well, okay, do we have things that we have been given to do and asked to be faithful with? Yes, we do. And there's the analogy, I need to be faithful just as these servants were called to be faithful. And it'd all be pretty straightforward. What makes this story interesting and a little bit tricky to get a hold of is this third servant, the one who takes the amount of money that he was given and buries it in the ground. What is the dynamic with that servant? What is he thinking and what's going on? What he says is, I knew you to be a hard man. And along with that, he says, you reap where you didn't sow, and you gather where you scattered no seed. So if I'm understanding what he's saying here, he's thinking about the fact that the master has gone away. He's not doing any of this work. He's not going in there and putting in the reaping and the effort to make this thing happen. He's going away, and he expects the servants to do it. And yet he's going to come back at the end, and he's going to expect to reap. He didn't sow, but he's sure going to expect to reap when he comes back. And so the servant is thinking about his master and saying, well, look, this is a hard man. If I don't give him what he wants, if I don't provide the profit that he wants, I'm going to be in trouble. And so this inspires him, the fear of how he might be in trouble if because the master's a hard man, leads him to do what might seem like a prudent thing, but you understand in the end is not prudent at all. He buries the money. Instead of investing it, instead of going out and working with it and trying to gain more money, he buries it in the ground. Because what he's afraid of is, if he goes and does anything with it and works with it, he might lose it. And then is he going to be in trouble? A guy who expects a profit, if you tell him, I lost the money you gave me, boy, am I going to be in trouble. So his fear leads him to, and I think we would have to say his fear and his evident lack of concern for his master's best interests and what his master really wants him to do, he goes and he hides it. And when he comes back, he says, look, I was afraid of you because I know you're a hard man. You expected a profit, and I was afraid, so I hid it, the idea being so that I wouldn't lose it, so that when you showed up, I could give it back to you. So here it is. You have what is yours. I didn't lose it. Here it is back. But the master, rightly enough, comes along and says, wait a minute. You knew that I expected to make a profit. You knew that I expected to reap where I hadn't sown. So what made you think that I was going to be happy with getting it back? If you knew that I was the sort that expected a profit when I returned, then clearly you ought to have made a profit, huh? So why didn't you at least take it down to the bank and put it in the bank, let somebody else borrow it and work with it, and make some interest on it that way? Let somebody else work with the money at least, so that you could show a profit when I returned. Because you knew, after all, that in the end what I was looking for was a profit. So your fear, based on the knowledge that I was a man who wanted a profit, led you to do a really stupid thing. You did the one thing that was guaranteed not to make a profit, and so you blew it. Something like that seems to be what's happening in this little story. Well, what is that about? What's being pictured here? Here's where I want to step aside for a second, and I just want to tell you what Jack has said about this, which I think is very intriguing. I could take no credit for this. I would be willing to steal it and claim it as my own, except that I'm not convinced yet that it's true. So I only steal stuff that I'm convinced is true. So let me tell you what he says, And we'll talk about this a little bit. Jack, the funny thing about the way Jack does this is that Jack asks the question right up front, the place where I wouldn't start, this is where he starts. He says, what does the talent represent? And he asked himself the question, if we look at this story, we see something that is entrusted to the servants, they're expected to work with it, and there is expected to be an increase at the end. What could that be? And Jack, I think, with a great deal of... I think it's a very clever solution to the parable. He's proposed, look, what if the talents represent what we might call wisdom? That is, God has imparted to us, like the sower who sowed with the seed, God has imparted to us a certain amount of knowledge, a certain amount of understanding of what is true. The gospel has been preached to us. And so we've been given a certain level of understanding and entrusted with it. And of course there are those who just put it aside and they lose it immediately. I mean, they're not interested in it and they never really go anywhere with it. What sort of a thing is there that you could, on the one hand, if you worked with it, it would increase, but if you don't work with it, it just sits there and in the end you just have what you had when you started with? And that's where Jack's saying it seems like wisdom really fits that bill, because if you think about it, in the proclamation of the gospel, there is the rejection of the gospel and just like losing it, throwing it away. There are those who respond to it, who hear it, who take it into their own lives, who believe it, and in thinking about it and living with it and pursuing it, end up gaining. They do business with it, and in the end they gain. They come to understand more than when they started. And we're not talking so much about biblical knowledge, like, you know, knowing the order of the books of the Old Testament or something like that, which, by the way, I hope you realize is not one of the qualifications for getting into the kingdom of heaven, knowing the order of the books in the Old Testament. I have never been able to get the order of the books of the Old Testament down, so I'm quite convinced that that's the case. But what we're talking about here is wisdom in the sense of having parts of the truth come home to us so that we understand it, so that we see what it's about, so that there is an increase, that we mature, we become more than we were when we started. Jack is saying, that's a kind of a nice analogy, because there is that middle ground. There is a way of taking in the truth, the wisdom that has been entrusted with it to you, and burying it in the ground. That is, you don't lose it. You don't throw it away and say, I don't believe it, and forget it. But you don't work with it either. You just take it and say, okay, here it is, and I'm just gonna believe it. I'm going to bury it in the ground so that time comes and the true-false test for getting into heaven comes and said, did you believe that? I'll say, yeah, I did. But you didn't work with it. You didn't make it your own. You didn't embrace it and actively believe it and come to understand the implications for it for you. You just sort of said, okay. And Jack's saying, he thinks that's a very nice analogy, that burying it in the ground is that way of refusing to really get in there and work with what you've been given. And you could even say that the analogy carries over in that it's that fear of that recognition that God is demanding, that God expects something of us, that might be the justification that someone would use. I can't start exploring this and thinking about it and living with it and testing it and living it out because I might lose it. Better to just say, I believe it and forget about it. Stick it in the ground and not worry about it. Okay, now, let's just pretend for a minute that that's in fact what the parable is teaching. I think there's something profoundly true about what Jack is saying there. If this is what the parable is teaching, then I think the message that it has for us is a very important one. Because ultimately, the truths of the gospel are things that we have to engage in ourselves. We have to take them on. They're not just intellectual games to play. They're not just pieces of knowledge to have, but they are truths about life that I am either going to embrace and live by, or else in the end they're going to be irrelevant to me and I'm going to live in the light of other truths. All of us are making decisions as we live about what is my life about? What am I basing it on? What is the bottom line for me? What do I think is important? What Jack is saying is right. Then the picture here would be Jesus saying how important it is that as he's gone, he has entrusted us with a certain amount of his treasure, in that he has given to us an understanding of the gospel, an understanding of what's true, an understanding of who God is, what the kingdom of God is about, and so on. And in entrusting that to us, he expects us to work with it. He expects there to be more of what he gave us when he comes back, in the sense that these truths we have taken on, we have thought about them, we have lived them, we have come to understand the importance of them, so that we are people who have more wisdom than when we started. The wisdom that he entrusted us with in the form of the gospel has blossomed and it has grown and turned into a deeper and truer wisdom that is based in my own life and heart and experience and thinking and so on. Well, I like it. Just a second, Gordon. I'm going to open it up here for all of your comments in just a second. I like it. I like what Jack is saying, and in fact, it may be right. I don't know why I can't just grab a hold and say, yeah, that's what it is, yet. There's something, maybe I'm just stubborn. It's possible. I will admit that I have been stubborn in the past. I don't do it anymore, but once or twice, I suppose I have been stubborn in my thinking about this stuff. What does strike me about this parable that is important that we retain somehow in our understanding of how this fits together is that the two parables that I talked about before, each of them centered on the idea of the absence of someone. The way the servant interpreted the absence of his master in the first parable, the way the maidens chose to deal with the absence of the bridegroom in the second one. And in the last parable we're going to look at, there is this surprising turn where Jesus says to people, essentially, you're going to be judged based on how you treated me while I was gone. So again, the whole thing centers around this idea of the absence of Jesus and the problem that that represents to us. So there's something in me in this parable that would like to see the emphasis of the parable, the whole idea of it, revolving around the problem that this one servant is having with the absence of the master. That as he looks at that, it's the fact that he reaps where he didn't sow. That he's looking at his absence and that he expects me to do something while he's gone that becomes the very problem, the stumbling block that drives the servant. If that were true, then I would see how these parables are fitting together very well. Clearly, at least, we can say that however we understand the intricacies of the dynamics of the story, at least this is one more of those stories where Jesus is warning his disciples and us that he is going to be gone and that we are going to have to live in a certain way in the light of that absence. He is going and he has something for us to do. And that defines our lives as followers of Jesus. Either we will fulfill the task, whatever it is, however we understand what it is that He's tasking us with, either we will fulfill that task faithfully or we won't. And that in the end, that's the thing that's going to tell the story. That's the dynamic that informs all of these parables. Okay, now we've got a little time. Let me start with Gordon, who had a question or comment, and then I'm interested in any thoughts you may have.
What Jack says, as far as, what he put in there as far as faith, as far as the things that God gives us, does he also draw from that the idea of the mysteries of the kingdom he's talked about in chapter 14, which are given to the disciples?
I couldn't speak for Jack. I don't know. I don't know. What do you mean by that? What? How are you putting those things in?
Well, when you talk about the knowledge of wisdom, it's the idea of the mysteries of the kingdom, understanding God's ways, righteousness. Because I was rereading through all those chapters. I see how all those parables fit together. And I never saw that before.
Yeah.
It's the first time that I've had teaching on this parable where it's talking about making money, it's talking about the things
right.
Money, the
price
that you have,
right.
Your talents, and stuff like that.
Right.
And now, it doesn't mean that the person needs to sit in there to a certain degree.
Right.
It isn't the one of
them. Right. That's a good point. I am almost certain. I mean, since I can't for myself convince myself that this is the way that the parable needs to be taken, I can't say this absolutely, but I am pretty darn sure that the point of this parable is not that we're supposed to make money. Which you will find taught. You will find people who teach that this parable is giving us an example of basically that we have been charged by Jesus with going out and making a profit for the kingdom, as in making money. And that, I think, really misses the whole spirit of the analogies that the parables are. That what we understand how money works in this world. And he often uses money and treasure and jobs and all of those kinds of things as an analogies for how you deal with the treasures of the kingdom in one sense. But it's very, very unlikely that he actually means that we ought to be going out and making money. Logan?
I'm wondering if the parable of the virgins and the parable of the talents, is his purpose to tell us who God is or who we are in this? Because it seems, on the one hand, really cut and dry, almost frighteningly so, that God could just say, sorry, the door's closed, like he did with Noah. Too bad. And he refers to this servant that didn't do anything with money, calls him lazy and wicked. He doesn't say, oh, you poor thing, you were afraid.
Right.
He really uses some harsh language there.
Right.
You're lazy and you're wicked. You're out of there.
Right.
And with the 10 virgins, they all went out there. He just calls the one foolish and the one wise because they brought oil. And the foolish ones, they did get up and go get oil. So we're not going to share any of ours with you, but go get some, go buy some. So while they're on their way to get some, the door's closed. And they come back and it's like, sorry, the door's closed. And this lazy, wicked servant, it's not like he went out and spent the money.
Right.
Or squandered it, or flipped it, or lost it, like you said. He actually was like, okay, I didn't lose anything here.
Right.
And I'm just kind of thinking, is he saying, look, you've had plenty of warning. We're separating the wheat from the chaff here. The people who are really hungry and really chomping at the bit, they're going to bring extra oil. They're going to go out and invest this. They're really going to be aggressively pursuing the bride or the master. And the other people are just talk. And the people who are just talk impress the master as being just worthless. I mean, is that what he's saying?
Well, yeah, I think you're right. It's interesting to compare the first parable where we have a clear rebellious indifference and disobedience to the master. He says, take care of these servants, and the as soon as he's gone, he says, hey, he's gone, I'm going to beat up on everybody and get drunk. And so there it's very clear that the servant is not at all interested in what the master had to say. So that one's very easy, because it's just out and out rebellion and indifference. What's striking about the next two is with the 10 virgins, they were all waiting for the bridegroom. I mean, in this story, it wasn't that five of them stayed home and said, who cares? I don't even know who's getting married, and I mean, they were all there waiting. And I think that is intended to represent, just like the parable of the soils, where you have three of the four soils that are described, actually the seed starts to germinate and grow up. But it's either the shallowness of its root or the competition in the soil that ultimately squeezes it out and it doesn't come to anything. I think Jesus really does have this picture that there are other ways to miss it than to just totally be indifferent and blow it off. That there's a kind of a half-hearted sort of interest, like the maidens who didn't bring enough oil to go the distance, or the servant who recognizes that I have to do something here, but he doesn't want to work with it because he might lose it. So I guess what I'll do is I'll just keep it and make sure I don't lose what I've got. That something in the stories is talking about the difference between those who were, just as you were saying, who had the commitment to this enterprise, whatever it was, to actually take it on and go for it, versus these ones who were sort of there but sort of weren't. And I think that's right. And that ultimately there is a warning in this. Why the five foolish maidens are in that story and why this servant is in this story is to show that there is a way. These are analogies. These are situations where there is a kind of a half-hearted, in a sense, acceptance of the task that ultimately doesn't yield what the master is looking for. And I think in that is, in fact, where the warning in these lies. It's where the five maidens went wrong, and where did this servant go wrong? That's what's at the heart of it. And it has something to do with that. Look, you didn't, whatever this thing is, you didn't take it on. You didn't exactly totally blow it off, but you didn't take it on either. And ultimately, only those who take it on are going to meet with the approval of the master.
Just a question. Are you suggesting this? Is it possible to? I guess I didn't hear a real clear understanding of how you would interpret it different than the way Jack would interpret it. Is it the case that you would interpret it? If you didn't accept Jack, would you interpret it in saying that there is no direct analogy between what the talents are supposed to mean and something else?
Well, you didn't hear it because I don't have it. I mean, I'm serious. When I say I don't really know what to make of it at this point. Everything, apart from the proposal that Jack is making, which makes sense to me, and I'm just kind of thinking about it and trying to see if ultimately that in fact is going to work. Nothing else that I've heard really satisfies me that it's meeting the picture. I mean, I've heard a number of proposals that people have made, and
does the talent have to represent something?
No, but that's not really the problem in the end. The question is what is it in the story? Where is the analogy? The talent wouldn't have to represent something, but something in the story is like the way we interact with the kingdom of God. And especially, I think, it's just very unlikely that this third servant, with this rationale that he has about how I better not, you know, I'm going to give it back to you, it just seems very unlikely to me that that's just an extraneous detail that doesn't have an analogy. That seems to be where the heart of the analogy is you don't want to be like this guy. And that's, I think, where we need to start, is the thing that makes the most sense, is that you don't want to be like him. What is it about him? What was he... what is it about the way he did it that we don't want to be like? That's where... See, I mean, obviously there's a simple answer. I mean, there's an element of unfaithfulness here that we don't want to emulate, and it's clear that I don't want to be that way. I mean, whatever it is, I may not know exactly what Jesus means, but clearly I have been called to pay attention to what he is asking of me and to somehow engage myself in it, whether it's belief or obedience or, I mean, whatever it is he has in mind here. There's something, and I need to take it seriously. So I can take that away from the story and say I don't want to be like this servant in the sense that I want to see what my master has given me to do and take it on. But see, with many of the parables that I could say I do understand, like the parable of the mustard seed, there's this sense, you look at the dynamic in the story and you say, yeah, that I see that. That makes sense. This poor guy who's going to lose his job and he's got it for a little while longer. He says, what can I do? I'm about to lose my job. I know. I'll stop serving my present master and I'll start working for guys that owe him money. I'm going to do things for them so that when I lose this job, I'll have some place to go. Well, that logic, that situation, like, man, I can't keep this. So while I've got it, I better do something to make sure I've got some place to go when I lose it. The sense of that, the wisdom of that really speaks through the story, and then Jesus is saying, you're like that. What you've got, you can't keep. And while you've got it, you'd better do something to make sure you've got someplace to go when you're done. That much of the story, I mean, the dynamic of it just kind of cries out. And many of the parables are like that. Treasure hidden in a field. There's this field and it's got a treasure hidden down there. Everybody else passing by looks at it, just sees a dumb old field. But I know that if I were to buy this field, go out and spend everything I've got, he says, to buy this field, that I would be gaining, not losing. Even though everybody else would think you're crazy to buy a field with everything you've got, what are you going to do with a field now that you've spent everything you've got? I know there's a treasure in it. That sense of there's something hidden in this that I see, something that other people have missed, but by the grace of God I have seen it, and so I'm willing to go for it. Again, that dynamic makes a lot of sense, and I can think about that and sort of feed on that dynamic and say, yeah, that's what Jesus is telling me. My life is like that. In this story, I can't do that yet for myself. I can't have that sense that I know, I see what it is about what the servant did here that is like my situation and how I ought to avoid it. I can sort of see my way to some possibilities, but I'm just not convinced yet. Bill?
I guess I agree with you, but I think it's the nature of the servants and their response to the master's absence that really is at the center and not the talents. It seems like the two that were praised are company men. They see the master's charge to them as an opportunity to serve the master's interests and not their own. The one who is condemned as a worthless servant. He didn't pursue the master's interest, he pursued his own. He was self-protective, self-serving, ultimately. He thought. Yeah. I guess I don't see a big problem there. I don't see... There is a dynamic there that works for me. I guess I'm not seeing...
Okay, well, let me ask you. If I understand what you're saying, then, the part about... I took one strategy, and here's your money back. And the master saying, if you knew that I wanted this, why didn't you take this strategy of putting it in the bank, and I would have gotten my money back with interest. It seems in the way you're understanding it that part of it is essentially just extraneous detail. That all that really carries over is that he was not... faithful in his charge.
He didn't have a heart to serve his master's interests.
Okay.
And that to me seems to be the bottom line.
Okay, well see, I can live with that. I mean, I like what you're saying. I just find myself thinking, though, That's a very interesting little twist of a detail to have in a story, that idea that there was something you could have done that would have served, that would have solved your problem and mine. It would have gotten me a profit and it would have been safe, and you were worried about being safe, weren't you? Now, you know, if that part of the analogy were to actually carry over, then I would find myself asking the question, is there actually some analog like that in our experience? Is there some safe alternative that could, you know, I don't know exactly how to answer that question, but that's the part that for me, there are a lot of choices at various spots. Does this detail carry over, or is that just part of the story? You know, in the parable of the prodigal son, we don't worry about, you know, he's eating the husks of corn. Would it have been different if it had been, you know, zucchini or something like that? I mean, is there some... No. I mean, you know, corn, kernels, little pieces, yellow. I mean, no. There's no significance to any of those things. Some of the details in a parable are just there to make the story more vivid and understandable as a story, but don't actually carry over with an analogy. This one has some very interesting details in it that I keep coming up against and saying, am I supposed to be carrying over the analogy there or not? And that's the part where I kind of go back and forth. Gordon?
As I was reading this today, the thing that I kept asking myself as far as the persons who did not have the extra oil, they already had oil in the land, so they just didn't bring the extra oil. And then this one who hid the talent, I started asking now, is this person being self-righteous? Doesn't he understand God's loving kindness, His grace? He's obviously fearful and afraid. And then I started thinking about a lot of the teaching that I've been hearing, which I totally like, and that is the fact that our hunger increased for righteousness grows, and our desire to serve grows, and deepens, and our understanding, our knowledge grows. And it seems like there's a lack of that. There's a lack of interest.
Yeah.
And then when you switch over into the next into the parable of the sheep and the goats, that's where you get into the real rubber meets the road and the practical side of all this. Is how is this all played out in your life? And this is how we relate to God and to one another.
Yeah, and that reminds me that there are other issues that you wrestle with in this parable as well. For instance, there are some who would argue that the servant's mistake was in thinking that his master was a hard man. That in fact, that wasn't true at all. But I don't know. He was happy with the other servants. They made the profit that he had asked them to make. And in the end, this servant is cast into the outer darkness because he didn't make the profit that he was asked to make. So I don't know that it's so unreasonable in the story to see the master as actually being the way the servant understood him to be. That he had something he expected him to do. And now, we have to be careful. See, we have to understand the story and then make the analogy. We can't just make the master in the story God and then say, what's God like? Because this is not a picture of earning your salvation. I mean, this is not God coming along and saying, if you're good enough, then I'll save you. That's not what Jesus would be saying. But he's making an analogy between a situation where a master expects something of his servants to whatever it is that Jesus is saying that he expects of his people. It might be something as simple as just saying faith, just persevering belief and a real embracing of the truths of the gospel personally. Maybe that's all that's involved. Or maybe it has implications out into what we do and act and so on. I mean, I would have my own case I would make about those things. But we don't want to... First, we want to recognize that Jesus is painting a picture, this analogy, just like he tells a story about an unjust judge and making an analogy, but he's not saying that God is like that judge. Or the slave who cheats his current master, but Jesus isn't saying that if I work for Hewlett-Packard, that I ought to cheat Hewlett-Packard. I mean, that it's an analogy. You look at the story, and then there's something that carries over. And the hard part with this one is that it's a little difficult to know what carries over. But at a minimum, I think, what I can say is that I think what ties these things together is this theme, which is very familiar to us because it's been 2,000 years and we're used to the idea that Jesus isn't here. But to tell a story about a master who goes away for a long time, leaving his servants to carry out tasks that he's left for them, that's a very surprising turn of events from the disciples' perspective, because that's not what they were expecting. But it should be, to me, it's encouraging to recognize that Jesus himself was well aware of the situation. He didn't know how long, I don't think, because he says he didn't know the day or the hour when this was going to wrap up. But he was well aware that this was a thing that was going to take a long time, and that what's called for, and that's why these parables are so relevant to us, is that what's called for during that very long period is recognition that it's going to be a long time and I need to be ready. As he says, you don't know the day or the hour, so you need to be prepared, in the sense that I am a servant serving my master and I don't know when he's coming back. The wise thing for me to do is to just keep serving him day after day, and whether he comes quickly or comes after a long time, I'm going to be ready if I'm taking it on in that sense. Otherwise, we see in these parables, there are all these different ways to go wrong, different ways to not deal with his absence and what we're supposed to do in that absence in the right way. Well, it's late. We got to stop. Next week will be the last of our discussions in Matthew, and at least I can say that when we look at the next part of it, I do know what I think is happening in that part.